Thank you, organizers, for the honor of participating in this symposium on sensory ecology. And my sensory system, of course, is a moth pheromone systems. And the connection that I want to make is the fact that the evolution of moth pheromone systems is probably directly tied to the evolution of species in the moths. And so this is something I've been concerned with for over four decades, and I want to go through a brief background of what we've been looking at and then lead up to the many questions that we still have that I hope somebody in the future will continue to look at as I go into my waning years in the pheromone system. And the pheromone system we're talking about in the moths is the female as an emitter and the male moth as a receiver. And to get at the evolution of these systems, of course, you first have to know what are they emitting. We have to define the pheromone that they're using. And so that's the first thing we did way back in the 60s, my first postdoc, Heinrich Arndt, and I looked at the red-banded leaf roller moth, and we went through traditional chemistry, 50,000 female tips, and we came up with the compound Z11 tetradecenyl acetate, which is Z11-14 acetate. And then we published that, and I looked at the publication, and we published it in Nature in 1968. And this is just an aside to the talk now. I looked at the publication list, and I said, holy mackerel, you know, we also published next year Oriental fruit moth in Nature, published the next one, oblique banded leaf roller in Nature, published the next one the next year with Rencardet in Science, and then the next year we published the next one with Andre Como in Science. Now here we have Nature, 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 Science, Science, and I have to say, in the last 20 years, it's been almost impossible to get anything in Nature or Science, no matter how interesting you think it is. But back in the early days, it was easy to get them in. We could actually get grants for the stuff back in the early days with just a good idea. Anyway, we started looking at other leaf rollers, and they found that they all use Z11-14 acetate. Now, that was a conundrum at that time. And then, of course, we realized that, well, to be specific, you have to have a blend of compounds. And when the capillary gas chromatograph came along, we saw that with one single female gland, you could get a blend of compounds that the female's emitting, and then we could show that the males were responding to a specific blend. Well, my postdoc, Heinrich Arndt, went back to Switzerland. He did a lot of work in pheromones, but he came famous because in the 1986, he collected all the pheromones of moths that were known at that time, put them in a booklet, and then he created the Ferolist on the web in the 1995, and that's what he's really he's famous for, putting it on the web. It's still maintained by Peter Witzko today, but he put all the pheromone that are known, and then luckily John Byers just a couple years ago put this all together in a database, did his software calculations, and he came up with a lot of interesting facts that I want to tap off today. He found that there were, at that time, pheromones for 1,572 moth species with a combination of 377 unique chemical compounds. Now, of course, you see that you have these moths that have to evolve over 300 different compounds, and the question is going to be, how do they evolve these 300 different compounds? Another interesting fact was that most of them use a Z configuration double bond, which is common in Nature. Oleic acid, palmitic acid are all using the Z conformation, and so it's not unlikely, because they use common pathways, they would use Z. But the fact that I wanted to show was that there are 172 species that use Z11-14 acetate. That was our compound. How come everybody else is using it? Anyway, the question is, how do 172 species evolve using different blends with that compound? This is something that we were struggling with, and we wanted to find an answer for that. And so the question is, if sex pheromones are highly specific and thought to be under stabilizing selection to optimize communication system, how can they evolve to another system? If you're stable on one system, how can you change to another one? That's the conundrum that we had. Well, looking at the biosynthetic pathways, Lubio said, came in the lab, and he found that there's a very common pathway that thousands of moths use. And that is, you develop this unique delta 11 desaturase, which is only found in the moth systems. And then working on different precursors, you can make either Z11-18, chop two carbons off and get Z9-16, chop two more carbons off. You can get these cascades of compounds, and now you have a series of compounds that you can choose from for a selective blend. And down here, you can see here's the delta 11 on 14 makes the compound for the red-banded leaf roller moth. And then the next one, which slid by, down here, Z712 acetate is the main compound for the cabbage looper made from this cascade of compounds. So from this common pathway, you can get a multitude of compounds. I'm skipping by my slides. Oh boy. Well, anyway, I can't back it. I got to back it up. Here we go. I got it. I was using the forward instead of the backwards. It's too tricky for us older people here. Anyway, from this cascade of compounds, you can see that there are the cabbage looper uses six compounds now, not only the main one, but Z914, Z714, Z512, saturated, and Z11, the delta 11-12 acid thing. Now, they make a selection from there. Now, I want to talk, how can you change to a different blend? And Ken Haynes gave me some slides to talk about his mutant moth, which is a good example. There's other examples in the literature, but I just wanted to use this one from Ken Haynes. And that is, he has a mutant moth in the laboratory that uses mainly Z914 acetate. And if one mutant gene stops this chain shortening and this chain shortening from occurring. So with one mutant gene, you can change your blend from using Z712 to using Z914. And so if you look at his moths in the laboratory, here's the normal one. Uses a lot of Z712 acetate and has Z512 acetate. But the mutant moth, with just one mutant gene in there, uses Z914 acetate and just a little bit of the Z12, and there is no Z5 in there. So now you have a completely different blend for this mutant moth because of that one gene that stops the chain shortening from occurring. And so that's how the females can change, and then you might say, well, how do the males follow that? If you take that female moth now and put it in the field, do you catch any cabbage looper moths? Probably not. What you catch are black cutworm moths, because that's the blend for the black cutworm. And so you have the females can change, but how do the males follow that? Well, he did some work in the laboratory, and we get an idea of how it might happen. He did a selection process, and over 49 generations of selection, he finally changed the ability of males. Some of them respond to the mutant blend, but they also respond to the normal blend. And after 49 generations, they kind of broaden their response, so they both respond very well to the mutant and the normal. So it's obvious you're not completely changed over to the mutant blend, even after 49 generations, but you are changing. And so it looks like males can start to change and to track over to the females. Maybe after a million years, you could track all the way over there. And so Larry Phelan put this tracking thing into his model, the asymmetric tracking model, and what he described that in a couple of chapters in the 90s. And what it says is, to explain moth pheromone evolution, the asymmetric tracking hypothesis talks about single response variability and the role of sexual selections. And here's a description that Tom Baker had in one of his write-ups. The higher selection pressure on the male's response system should select for some subset of the male population to follow major variations in females' blends over generations. So that's a tracking part. If the female changes something else, the males track over to it. So that's a hypothesis. Now the question is, does that really happen? And can that happen? So one thing you have to look at is their receptor. Here we have the antenna, they have the receptors on it, and in those hairs, those olfactory hairs, you have the neurons that receive the pheromone components. And I'm just going to briefly just show one thing that comes into play here. This is a slide given by Neil Vickers, because he makes some nice three-dimensional pictures of all these, the macroglomerulus. And you see the receptors on the antenna feed their information back to some domain of the macroglomerulus. So the main pheromone component, Z1116-aldehyde here, will go to this main domain right here. Now the other minor components and antagonists will have their domains they come in. They're specific places in the macroglomerulus where they feed back to. So you have receptors on the antenna and you have these special domains here. So the question is, what happens if the female makes a compound that's not present in the male? How can they respond and track over to it if they don't have any receptors or a place in the macroglomerulus that responds to it? So that's something that we have to cope with. Well, I had a real question when I went to New Zealand in 1984 and I saw these leaf rollers. They had a leaf roller, the Planotorctrex, and throughout the North Island they were all called one species. But if you went into different geographical areas of that island, we found out that they had different pheromone systems. They looked the same, but their pheromones were different enough that they had different compounds. They were using Z514 acetate, and another place they were using Z814 acetate. So here you have a jump in the compounds. How can they evolve, and they're very closely related, how can you jump from this system to this system? And it happened with another leaf roller there. Again, they had this jump from one compound to another completely different compound. So these questions were in my mind, and we still are wondering, how can this happen? So we started to look at a system now on the corn boards, which we felt would give us some idea of how you can jump from one compound to the next, because the European corn borer and the Asian corn borer have different pheromone systems, and we wanted to see how they could evolve. And the Asian corn borer, which is a Spernochelys here, somehow or another, a million years ago, just kind of evolved from this some population of other corn borers or other Austrenia that use the delta 11 desaturase as their enzyme. And so of all the pheromones of Austrenia that are known, they all use either Z11, E11-14 acetate. And so they're using a delta-11 acetate. But here's a strange thing out here. This Asian corn borer uses a delta-14 desaturase. And when you look at it, the biosynthetic pathways are completely different. They're completely different. Here's a European corn borer. It takes 16 carbon acid, chain shortens to 14, puts a double bond in to get Z and E11-14. Now the Asian corn borer starts with 16, and the delta 14 desaturase already puts a double bond in, so you get E and Z 14, 16 carbon acid, and then that chain shortens down to Z and E 12. So you have completely different biosynthetic pathways. So you say, how does a female, first of all, jump from this system over to this system? Well, we got kind of a clue for that a few years ago when we were looking at the desaturase genes. We were characterizing desaturase genes in a number of insects to see what might be the most interesting. And when we did the corn borers, we came up with a real surprise. We found that the European corn borer had both genes for the delta 11 desaturase and for the delta 14 desaturase. They had both of them. And the Asian corn borer had exactly the same genes. This was amino acid for amino acid. There was no mutations there. They were exactly the same genes. And the only difference is that the European corn borer has the delta 11 active and the delta 14 is silent. And in the Asian corn borer, the delta 11 is silent and the delta 14 is active. So you can see that if there's some stochastic event or something happens to turn off one and turn on the other one, you can make a jump from one desaturase to a completely different desaturase. And so we can speculate that that could have happened in the corn borers because the mechanism for that happening is present. And so now we're left with a question, and this is what we're dealing with today, is how did males responding to delta 11 pheromone compounds track over to the new delta 12 pheromones to generate a new species? So the females can jump, but now the question is, who's going to respond to them? How do the males of the European corn borer respond to this new blend that comes out with the delta 14? Well, first of all, we want to look at the electrophysiology again. And here we're collaborating with Tom Baker and Michael, and they're doing the cut tip technique on the corn borers to find out what kind of receptors they had. Because I said, if you don't have the receptor for it, how can you have the variability of responding to the new blends? So we were collaborating with Tom Baker and Mike, and they did a lot of cut tip electrophysiology, and I'm not going to go into the details of that, but they puffed across all of these neurons, the compounds, the ENZ11-14s and the ENZ12s, and all the compounds involved with the two different corn borer species to see what kind of receptors they have. And they did the spike patterns with a Asian corn borer and with a European corn borer. And when they got done, what they found was that, well, most of the corn borers have a large neuron and a small neuron. And they found that the large neuron usually is responsive to the main pheromone component. So in this case, European corn borer in the E strain, the large neuron responds to 11, 12, 14 acetate. But what they found that it also has a variability of responding to the Z12 and an E12. And in the Asian corn borer, they found the same thing, that they respond to their main components, Z12 and E12, but they also respond to the components of the European corn borer, Z11 and E11. And so the receptors evidently are broad enough tuned to not only respond to the 11s, but to the 12s. And you might say that, well, the Asian corn borer, they developed this delta 14. They made E and Z 14, 16 carbon acid first. If they had ended up with that as the acetate, these receptors probably never would have picked it up. But they were smart enough to chain shorten it down to a 12, and this E and Z 12, 14 carbon, is close enough that these receptors do respond to it. So now we have a mechanism on the antenna showing that they can respond, but what about behaviorally? Do they actually respond? And so we're sitting in coffee break one time, and I was talking to Charlie Lynn, who does the behavior, and I said, what do you think? Do any of our males of the European corn borer respond to the Asian corn borer Delta 12s? Well, we had never thought about that before. We never tested them because we had never thought it was even a question before. So he said, let's go in the lab and you screen like 2,000 males and see if one of them's going to respond. Well, they went into the lab, and what he found was that with a Z strain, yeah, the Z strain responds mainly to the 97% Z and not very well to the components of the Asian corn borer. And the same thing with the E strain, they respond very well, go all the way up to the source, to mainly the E compound, and not very well to the ACB. But the thing is that the not very well is enough. The not very well is that for the last 5 years, we've had a consistent 3 to 5% of the males that respond also to the ACB blend. So 3 to 5% of them respond to the Z as well as to the ACB blend. And then same thing with the E-race. About 3 to 5% of the European corn borers will respond to the Asian corn borer blend. And so what we have is what we call the rare males. We have 3% rare males that respond not only to their own blend, but they'll respond to the blend of the Asian corn borer. And these 3% is what we think gives us a variability of them being able to track over to the females who are producing this completely new blend. And that's what we're proposing, but we still have, now that's what we're working on. And we did some crosses, we wanted to put in an NSF grant, and of course you have to have it half done now in order to get it. And so we started doing some of the work that we want to do in the grant, and we did some crosses, we did some line crosses, and what we found when we crossed an ACB male with a European corn borer female, the response of the F1 was they responded mainly to the European corn borer and a little bit to the ACB, but when we did the F2s, we got a great surprise. We got some responding to the Z blend and to the ACB like we would expect, but some of them responded to the E blend alone. This is for the European corn borer E strain, which the Z strain, this thing never responds to the E. Here in the F2s, we got them responding to the E, not only to that, but the E and the ACB. So here we have some really strange males when you do these crosses. There's something funny happening in the genetics of these crosses, and this is what we need to look at. And we want to get at that. So we want to investigate the genetic architecture underlying this male response in ECB and ACB. And we're going to do it two different ways, hopefully. We're going to do line crosses of the ACB and the ECB to evaluate the genetic model that tests for effects due to additive, dominance, epistasis, and maternal effects. Now, you see, I don't know anything about genetic models like this, but we have a collaborator at Hobart College, Dave Joni, who's going to do us and tell us what we have to do and do all of this stuff. But what we can do in the laboratory is a selection study. We want to see if we can select those rare males and increase the number from 5% up to maybe we get a whole strain of rare males if we can. So we can study what is the basis of the rare males, why they can respond to both the ECB and the ACB. So we started a selection study, and we've already run one of them. And what we did for the selection study is that we would select for 30 rare male responders, and then we mated those with lab females. And we set up 21 families. We have 21 separate families. And Callie Musto is doing all the work, and it's a huge process to keep all these things separate. Run the 21 families through, take the males from it, fly them in the flight tunnel, and find out which ones have the most of the rare males in it. Then we take the 7 best families with the most rare males, and we mate them with the next 7 families, to the females of the next 7 families, and then drop the lowest families. So we're always trying to make a selection for the most number of rare males. And we did this for 9 generations. And after 9 generations, we increased responders to the ACB, the number of rare males, from 6% to 24%. And we found that there is a genetic basis to that. And so what we also found was that it's not a mater gene. We didn't move it very rapidly. We didn't move it completely. And so it's under some kind of a polygenic control. There's a lot of genes involved underlying that rare males. And it's very difficult to move with the selection process we have. And so we found that we need to use a different selection process and see if we can move it again. But in the experimental design, this 24% turned out that we call them responders to the ACB, But many of them are what we call funny flyers. And this is one thing I want to leave with, is that we have now generated something that Charlie Lynn said he's never seen before in the flight tunnel. Maybe we have a means of looking at orientation of moths in something different, because we have moths now that don't respond like any other moth in the flight tunnel that we've had. Did that thing ding off already? Huh? I didn't hear the ding. Oh, you should have donged me or something. Well, actually, here's a flight tunnel. This is how they normally fly. This is Gend anyway. This is how they normally fly. They go right to the source, and that's a normal flight of a male to the source. Now, these funny flyers, there are going to be two examples. They get up there, and they don't exactly fly in the plume. Now, what Charlie says is that males don't fly upwind unless there's a reason for it. They fly upwind because they're in a pheromone plume, and the pheromone plume brings them forward. These funny flyers are flying outside of the plume. And then the crazy thing is that when they get close, as soon as they're kind of flop, this one's flopping around a little, but he goes out of the plume. And then when he gets to the source, he doesn't even care about the source. He goes right on by. They go right on by to the back of the tunnel. So that, you know, it's something that we never see with any other moth. And so when we're selecting for these genes for rare males, what we find is that we're increasing the number of genes for the rare males, but we're also increasing something else that's causing them to have a completely different orientation than what we'd normally have. And so now we have something that we can really look at for orientation. There's something screwed up with those genes, and this is where we really are in our work. So after four decades, we're left with many questions for future research, and we hope that somebody will carry it on from here. Thank you. We don't know. We've looked for them in the field. We have not found any evidence of those rare males in the field as yet. But we did get a population of corn borers from Iowa from a completely different lab stock, and they have the rare males as well. And they have actually a lot of funny flyers. You might expect that from Iowa, I guess. But I don't.